Yeah. Good morning. This I'm sort of happy to say is sad to say in a way. It's going to be Norma's on my left.
Can't do that. Grammar in there somewhere.
It's going to be our last Sunday doing this ministry on men, women, and machines. We have a guest speaker today. I'll introduce a little later. And we are going to invite the gallus today for modeling all our aspects. I was thinking that I could come up with Mother Courage, Mother Wit, Mother of Invention, Mother Country. We use that. Any others? Mother and apple pie, I've got over here.
Mother Nature,
Mother Earth.
Just Mother.
Mother Jones.
The word carries a lot of meaning. And so, for Mother today, we light a chalice.
He's changing the script on me, that's why there's little dialogue. How many people under 4'9" do we have in here today? Can we see their hands? I can see one.
Katie.
Five,
middle
school,
six.
No. How many people under the age of 15 who are more than 4'9" do we have? Today we're going to talk about patents. Do any of you know what patents are? Do you have any idea, any of you?
One of the big guys in the background.
Would anybody, yes, you'd like to tell us what patents are in one sentence?
Patents are little tools that lack the threat.
And very shiny.
Why don't you tell us what patents are in one sentence, Michael?
Jesus, too bad, I'm sorry.
I'm no expert in this. I'm going to do it in very, very lay terms. I'm sure I'm going to be corrected later. A patent is a way of registering your invention with the government and making sure that you are the only person that's going to profit from it, unless you want others to, for a set number of years. That is one sentence.
Profit monetarily.
Right.
We would profit perhaps by the invention, but perhaps not monetarily.
That's a very good point. We may begin with that, I think. But so that the inventor has profit from it monetarily.
And we're going to be discussing whether patents are, quote, a good thing, or sometimes a good thing, sometimes not so good, and what the advantages and the disadvantages are. And in particular, the reason why we're going to discuss this today in middle school, as you might be particularly interested in this, is in the last 8 or 9 years, we have opened the door and have begun to patent forms of life. And that raises some really big ethical questions. So if you're interested in the answers, you're going to have to ask your parents. Sorry about that. But before you go, let's sing the garden song.
Number 59
in your songbooks.
Oh, this.
This
Chance to make your mark on the future of the Prairie UU Society and the whole congregation, the assembly. So please, it's very, very important. So please don't run off without doing it. We'll be setting it up in the back of the auditorium here. And you'll find out.
Okay. Go now in
peace. Go now in peace. May the Spirit of God surround you everywhere you may go. Everywhere you may go.
Seated to my left is our friend Deb Johnson. I worked with Deb for about 4 years, and as she puts it, we spend an awful lot of time in prison together. When I worked with her, she was doing the same line of work I do, which I've talked about here. Before that, she was an assistant district attorney in Sheboygan County. She has worked for the Department of Natural Resources and is just about to work for them again. But in between all of this, she managed to find time to become a patent attorney, which is not easy. She took the exam, passed it on the first shot, both parts. And for the past year or so, she has been working for a patent law firm here in Madison, Deb Johnson.
I want to thank Mike and Norma for giving me a chance to come here today and talk about some things that I find very interesting. A lot of times you're called upon to give talks on things that aren't very interesting, but I find this information interesting, and I think that you probably will too. I understand from Mike and Norma that you people like to discuss things and raise a lot of difficult questions, So feel free at any time during my talk to interrupt me if there's something that you don't understand or if there's a question you want to ask. But I'll tell you just briefly what I'm going to do, and then I think what Mike and Norma are going to do. And I'm basically going to give you some background information on patents in general, what they are, how you get them, how they're structured within our government, and go from that a little bit into what is a fairly new area, and that is the application of traditional United States patent law to the area of biotechnology. And at that point, I think that I can raise a few questions that people talk about with respect to biotechnology patents in general, or in particular, patenting life forms. And I think Mike and Norma can take over from there. So in starting out, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about patents and how they're obtained. Patent law falls within the general area of law, which is known as intellectual property law. That's in contrast to what we know traditionally as real property law, the law that says that you buy your house, you buy your land, you own that, and you have certain rights. Intellectual property law is patent law, copyright law, trademark law, and trade secret law. Those areas are all very distinct, but they are connected in that they all deal with a way that our society, government, allow us to protect things that are the product of the human mind. A patent, as Mike described it, is a grant to an inventor from the United States government. The patent itself is a legal document very much like the deed to property. A deed to property will set forth the meets and bounds of the property that you own. A patent document is a piece of paper, and it sets forth in a different manner the meets and bounds to what you claim as an inventor is your intellectual property. And that is done in the document in a special way that's called a patent claim. And the claim starts out, there's a heading that says claims at the end of a patent document that says I claim or we claim, and then in words attempts to describe what it is that's your invention, and you may only claim that which doesn't belong to somebody else. Just as you can't have overlap, well, theoretically can't have, but do sometimes have in the law, overlapping pieces of property. In the patent law, you also can't have overlapping pieces of property, and if you do, you get in a fight with the other person, and you have to hash out where that line is drawn. Yes?
Can you patent an idea without a mock-up or something?
Yes, you can. In the United States, you don't need to have a physical model. The Patent Office formerly required submission of models, and in fact, if you go to Washington, D.C., they have a museum full of a lot of very interesting models that people had built. But for the most part, you are not required to submit a working model, and in fact, you don't even have to have shown that your idea can work yet. There is a concept that's called reduction to practice. But reduction to practice does not mean that you actually have to have a working model. It means that you have to have enough information presented to show that it would work. And actually, by filing a patent application in the United States, you have what's called constructive reduction to practice. So if you can tell people how to do it, and you can put that down in writing, even if you haven't built it yet, so to speak, you can sort of claim that date as your date of reducing it to practice. The one area in which the Patent Office still does require models is something that happens quite a lot. People are always coming up with perpetual motion machines, in which case if they submit a patent application for a perpetual motion machine, the first thing the Patent Office is going to say is, in this case, we require a model. So they can still do that, but you don't have to do it. So in any event, the claims in the patent serve the same function as the property description, and they do set forth the meets and bounds of the invention and what the inventor claims as his or her own. Patents are granted also in other countries in the world. In fact, most countries in the world have some sort of patent system. They do differ from the system in the United States, and as anyone who's ever had something patented or worked in the area of patents knows, it can be quite a lot of work and quite a lot of expense to protect your invention in many countries of the world. There are ways to cut down on the work. There is a patent cooperation treaty among countries in the world, and participating nations can have one application filed in one country to preserve a filing date, and then at a later date, you can go through the steps of actually obtaining the patent in each individual country. European countries also have a European Patent Convention where you can do the same thing in European countries. But the bottom line is that it's time-consuming and it's quite expensive to obtain patent protection in the United States as well as in other countries. The United States patent is a property right of a sort, but I think that we need to distinguish it from other types of property rights. It's a right to exclude. And what the patent right is the right to exclude others within the United States from making, using, or selling your invention. And the period generally is for 17 years for utility patents, which is what most patents are. There are also design patents, which are a funny little area of the law that I'm not going to talk about, and those are for a term of 14 years. The exclusive right is limited for a period of time, as I said, generally 17 years. And after the patent expires, anyone is free to use the invention. Patents do not enforce themselves. They're just a piece of paper. And if you want to enforce it, if someone is infringing your patent, you need to go to federal court and sue them successfully. And it's very interesting because my husband picked up the paper this morning and said, oh, here's an article on patents. And picture of Robert Kastenmeier, who, as I'm sure some of you know, is on the committee that deals with patents. And the point of the article is that patents are now being upheld by federal courts. And it's interesting because that was not the case for many, many years. In fact, for quite a few years, the trend, I think, in industry in the United States was away from getting patents, because people would go to the expense and trouble of getting a patent, and then if they got involved in an infringement lawsuit with a competitor, they went to court, they generally lost. And you know, people can speculate as to why that was happening, but it was in fact happening. The cases were heard in the different federal district courts, which are all across the country, and depending upon which court you went into, you were more or less likely to have your patent upheld. But for the most part, patents were not upheld by the courts. So people were beginning to wonder why they should even bother to get them. A few years back, there was a change, and that was the creation of the Federal Appeals Court for patents. So now there's one court in Washington, D.C. that hears all patent appeals cases. And since that court has been established, and that's a court with a specific expertise in the area of patents, patents are now upheld 80% of the time. It used to be the other way around, that they were found invalid 80% of the time. So because of that, industry in this country is much more interested in patenting, because patents are obviously worth more if they're enforceable. As far as what may be patented, generally it has to be something that falls within the technological arts. So it has to be something that's capable of being embodied in a thing, or a process which works upon a thing. You can't patent an abstract idea. You can't patent what's generally referred to as a principle of nature. And for the most part, you can't patent something like a mathematical formula, although in the age of computer science, that has changed. And that's not a statement that you can really make anymore. As I will discuss later on, and as Norma mentioned, one big change recently in the last 10 years is that you can now obtain a patent on a life form. And that's what we're going to be talking about later today. First, I'd like to go into a little bit about how a patent is obtained, in case some of you aren't familiar with that. What you need to do to get a patent is you file an application with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. The Patent and Trademark Office is a branch of the Department of Commerce, and building in Washington, D.C., and a whole crew of what are known as patent examiners. Patent examiners are people who are trained in a particular field or are experts in a particular field. So if I have an invention that falls within the what would be known as a certain area of chemical arts, I file that application, and that application goes to be examined by a group of people that specialize in that area of technology. It's then examined to see whether or not it is patentable. And that decision is made on a number of grounds which are set forth in the statute. Whatever it is that you're seeking a patent on has to be new. It has to be something that was not previously known. And in determining whether it was previously known, the patent examiners have access to a huge scientific library. They have access to all past issued patents, which are cataloged according to areas of technology, and they do a search. And they just look and see whether your idea has been patented previously. If they decide that it hasn't been, then the next question that's raised is whether it's something that's really worthy of a patent. And that determination is the non-obviousness determination, as it's referred to in the patent law. The question is, if you're in a particular field, somebody comes up with something, it's new, it hasn't been out there before, but if it's something that would have been obvious to somebody working in the field, then the government's not going to give you a patent on it. And your patent application will be rejected, basically saying, look, this would be obvious to anybody skilled in the art. And the test is always not whether it would be obvious to you or to me, but whether it would be obvious to another person of ordinary skill in the particular art to which it pertains. Then the other things that are considered are, losing my place here for a minute. The examination is completed, and generally the first time you apply, the patent office will reject your patent application. That happens 90% of the time, and it's sort of a little game, and you go back and forth. And so you send in the application, and the patent office will send it back and say, no, it's really not patentable. And generally the reason they say it's not patentable is because it's obvious to someone, a skill in the art. And they will throw at you a bunch of references to things that are close to your invention. And there's sort of a good reason for doing that, because when you are dealing with something that's not tangible, like a piece of land, it is hard to know where to draw the line. And what the patent office is really asking you to do is to clearly define how your invention differs from these other things that are close to it that are out there. So getting a patent is sort of a game, and I guess you can sort of look at it as getting a piece of the pie. And if you look at the pie as being one area of technology, there are going to be certain slices that have already been taken. So when you are applying for a patent, the trick is to get as much of the rest of the pie as you can without taking some of what's already been taken. So it's a fine line. And by rejecting your patent application on the grounds of obviousness, generally what the patent office is doing is saying, just tell us more clearly where that line is. So you go back and forth, sometimes several times, and eventually the patent office either has to reject your application or grant you a patent. And once you get the patent, it's a piece of paper, and the patent office is really good at putting ribbons and gold seals on everything. They really look neat. And that's what you have. And after that, it's up to you, as I said, to enforce the patent, because it doesn't enforce itself. Now, obtaining a patent is very costly and time-consuming. And you might ask, well, why is that? And I think that there are some pretty good reasons that as a society we should make it difficult for people to get patents. And that is because we are a society that favors free competition in the marketplace. A patent, as I've just told you, is a monopoly. It's a 17-year grant to exclude other people from making, using, and selling that invention. Now, if the government is going to give you that type of a benefit, they're going to make it hard to get. And you can also question whether patents are justified at all. And that's a question that Norma raised, and that's a question that's been raised many, many times. The fact is, we have patents in the United States, and almost every other country has them also. But you can sit around and question whether it's justified. The theory behind granting patents is that by giving people an incentive, and the incentive being 17-year period in which they can financially benefit from that patent by licensing it to others or keeping it exclusively for themselves, you give them a reason to create new things to begin with, and secondly, to disclose those things to the public. And the basis for our patent laws is found in the United States Constitution. I think it's in Article 1, Section 8. And the purpose is to promote the useful arts and promote technology. The argument is that if you allow people to get a patent, you give them an incentive for disclosing this technology. The disclosure is in the form of the printed patent document, which once it is issued is a public document. And you can get them just about anywhere, including at the Wendt Library at the engineering campus here in Madison, because it is a federal depository. the patent application is basically what is published as the patent. And the trade-off between you and the government is that you tell the world how to make your invention, we'll give you the patent. So because of that, there are very stringent requirements on what you have to have in that application. The first one is you have to teach somebody how to do it. And that means that you don't have to teach me or Norma how to do it. You have to teach a person, again, of ordinary skill in the art to which it pertains, how to do it. So you don't have to start from the beginning and invent everything. You can assume a certain amount of knowledge because you're dealing with people who are working in that area. So you have to teach them how to actually do it, and you also have to disclose what's known as the best mode. So you can't keep for yourself the best way of doing it and disclose in your patent secondary or non-preferred ways of doing something. You have to tell them the best way of doing it, otherwise your patent can be found invalid and unenforceable. So that's sort of the trade-off between inventors and the government, and I'll leave it to you to talk about whether you think that patents are a good thing or a bad thing, but I'll just go from the point that they're here and we can get them, and I'll take it from there. Getting on to the topic of biotechnology, which is, I think, what you're really interested in here with this series that you've been, for the last 6 weeks, Mike? I'd start out by saying that biotechnology patents are not new. Louis Pasteur received a patent in the United States in 1973 for a process of fermenting beer involving the use of yeast. And yeast is, some people argue that yeast aren't living, but 1873, I'm sorry. Thank you. Off by a century. But the point is that, you know, biotechnology itself is not completely new. And in fact, as many of you probably know, much of the university here was built with money from different types of biotechnology patents. But when we speak today of biotechnology, most of us aren't thinking about processes such as making beer that incorporate naturally occurring organisms. We think about recombinant DNA technology and organisms that are not naturally occurring. Recombinant DNA technology, as I'm sure many of you know, is just what it says, recombining pieces of DNA, and those pieces don't have to be from the same species, they don't have to be from the same type of organisms. So you can insert genetic information from one organism into another organism. Most commonly, this is done by inserting pieces of DNA into a simple organism, such as a bacterium, so that the bacterium then has the genetic information to produce a product, and the product is a protein. And the advantage to this, after it was first done, which I think was in 1973, is that it opened the door to making a lot of products in marketable quantities. In the past, for example, you perhaps had to isolate a protein by growing a lot of something and purifying a protein from the whole mess. This opened the possibility of being able to actually generate that specific protein by putting the code information into a little bug and growing a lot of bugs and letting them crank out the product. Now, as I'm sure many of you recall, there was a lot of public debate back in the 70s when all of this was happening. And some of that debate continues today, but a lot of that has settled down. But the point is that scientists did recognize this as a very good technique for making protein products and as an alternative to purifying proteins. But with this new technique came the question, obvious question, of patentability of the living organism that was built to make protein. Now you might ask, why is it important to get a patent to the actual organism? Why not get a patent, as you've been able to do for many years, to the process involving the use of an organism? And the reason is that if you can't get a patent on the actual organism that's been built to make the product, you don't really have much protection at all, because bacteria are self-replicating. You only need a little bit and you can grow a culture. So if you make the bacterium that's going to produce the product, somebody gets a sample of it, they go to another country, start growing it, producing the product, and import the product back to the United States. And there would be absolutely no protection then from simply having process claims. So it was a question that needed to be wrestled with. And before 1980, the United States Patent Office flatly refused to grant a patent on such engineered organisms. And the reasons were not always clear, but they sort of boiled down to the Patent Office saying, this is not patentable subject matter. And the nature of the argument was pretty much, this is a type of scientific principle, which it really isn't. And the other argument was basically, you didn't make this organism, nature made it. This all changed in 1980 with a very important United States Supreme Court case, which was Diamond v. Chakrabarty. Diamond was the current commissioner of patents, and Chakrabarty was a researcher who built a bacterium that liked to eat crude oil. He did it by basically taking four plasmids, which are little circles of DNA that can be incorporated into a bacteria. And he had four different plasmids that conferred upon the bug the ability to break down certain components of crude oil. The Patent Office said, no, we will not give a patent on this. It was appealed and the Supreme Court disagreed with the Patent Office and said that that was patentable subject matter. The court basically said that a live man-made microorganism is patentable either as a manufacturer or as a composition of matter. In reaching that decision, the court talked about quite a number of things, including congressional intent when the patent law was drafted. And I don't know where this quotation comes from exactly, but it's all over the place and it's always cited, and that is that Congress intended that anything under the sun made by man be patentable. And that was what the court cited in that case. The court also said that it was illogical to say that the patent laws weren't designed to apply to living things because since 1930 there have been patents on plants. Plants are certainly living things. The court also said it was irrelevant that the technology was not known at the time the patent statutes were enacted. That's a fairly common problem. They just said it doesn't matter. And the court also said that any potential dangers of the technology really weren't a subject for the court to decide. That the court was to decide the legal issue of whether this was a patentable subject matter, and it was up to the legislature to decide if there were dangers here and enact regulatory legislation. Many people believe that that 1980 Chakrabarty decision really opened the door to the biotechnology industry in the United States. That's a question that can be debated both ways. Many people would say this technology would have come along and would have been exploited whether patents were available or not. But on the other hand, people do say that, and I think it's true, that in the marketplace, if you have a patent, you're much more likely to be able to get people to invest in the technology if they know that the technology is protected. We've come a long way since 1980 when the Supreme Court said that you could get a patent on a bacterium. As many of you probably know, approximately 2 years ago in April of 1988, the Patent Office issued the first patent on a higher organism, that was a mouse. And that created a lot of uproar in the press and in Congress, and that debate is still going on. And there's still a lot of legislation being introduced and debated in Congress concerning patenting of animals. This particular animal was what's called a transgenic animal. What they had done is researchers had inserted a gene into a mouse embryo, which was then incorporated into the genome of the mouse, and that gene made the mouse particularly susceptible to cancer. What they did was they created a mouse that was a very good research model. And in that respect, it met the criteria for patentability in that there was a utility, there was a use for it. And this followed on an announcement from the Patent Office just the year before in 1987, where the Patent Office had granted a patent on a non-naturally occurring genetically engineered oyster, basically. And after that, this debate was going on, should we patent animals, should we not patent animals? And finally, I think the Patent Office just forced the issue by issuing a public statement that said that they would consider man-made, non-naturally occurring higher organisms patentable subject matter. And sure enough, a year later, they issued the mouse patent to some researchers, which patent was assigned to Harvard University. this is where you get into all the interesting questions. And if you think about it, man has been messing around with the genes of plants and animals throughout the ages. We've been breeding animals as far back as anyone knows. And the difference here is that you can create a genetic change in an animal much more quickly. And that's even though these techniques are time-consuming, they're labor-intensive, they don't always work real well. But you can still incorporate a change much more quickly than you could with conventional breeding techniques. You also raise the issue of species differentiations and the question of being able to take a gene from man and stick it into a mouse. And that's not going to happen any other way other than through the intervention of man through these types of techniques. For now, the patenting of animals is a reality. At this point, I believe that most of the work in this area is with mice and, interestingly, with fish. But there will be more research in other areas. And then you get into a lot of other questions, the who owns life question. And I know, as I think many of you are aware, if you live in Wisconsin and you read the newspapers, the questions of ownership of farm animals. You know, you create a genetically engineered farm animal, you sell it to a farmer, who then has the rights to the progeny of that farm animal? The inventor or the person who bought it? Under traditional patent law concepts, it would be the inventor, and the farmer would have to pay the inventor royalties on all the offspring of that animal. That's not something that sits very well with a lot of people in the state and elsewhere in the country. At this point, I think I've talked long enough. I'd like to end up just by giving you a little bit of a laundry list of reasons for and against patenting transgenic animals. And I'm taking this out of, it's a very good publication, it's a government publication. Government can't copyright its publication, so I can quote from this freely.
Let me ask you a question about the mouse.
Sure.
On each mouse, do they have to do this operation, or after they've made this one mouse, is it self-replicating?
Yes, it's self-replicating.
I want to ask you a question, too.
Sure.
How about cows that produce lots and lots of milk, the thing we've been reading about?
Mm-hmm.
Are those patented?
Cows that produce lots and lots of milk?
Yes.
Well, the ones we've been reading about in the paper are cows that have been treated with bovine growth hormone,
okay.
GH. And
so that's not self-replicating, that's a treatment.
No.
It's into each cow.
Right. And that's a whole other. And when you're talking about a lot of these things, you have ethical questions, but you also have economic questions. And there are an awful lot of people out there who will argue that the economics are going to take care of the ethical questions because of the cost of some of these things and the economic realities in the marketplace, you're just not going to reach some of these questions. You know, they're academic questions, and that's all. But let me just end up by reading you a little bit of a list here that's entitled Arguments For and Against Patenting Transgenic Animals. The arguments for patenting transgenic animals. First, patent law regulates inventiveness and not the commercial use of inventions. So that argument is basically, look, we're talking law here, we're not talking commerce, and what the law decides is going to be further modified by the marketplace. Patenting promotes useful consequences such as new products and research into solutions of problems. Patenting is necessary if the nation's biotechnology industry is to be able to compete internationally. If patenting is not permitted, inventors will resort to trade secret protection, which could hinder the sharing of useful information. And I'd like to digress for just a minute here. Do you know what trade secret protection is? It's sort of the classic formula for Coca-Cola. You keep it a secret. Now, if you have an idea, the best way in the world to protect it is to just not tell. And that's sort of why the patent laws were enacted, and that is so to give people an incentive for telling people things. But trade secret protection is not really practical in the area of biotechnology, and the reason for that is because many of these things are self-replicating. And all you need to do is have one industrial spy come in and steal a little bit of it, and it's out there. The other thing is, a lot of these inventions cannot be practiced without disclosing how to do it. So trade secret protection is not really that practical in the area of biotechnology. The final argument for patenting transgenic animals is that patenting rewards innovation. Arguments against patenting animals are that patenting raises metaphysical and theological concerns. For example, it promotes a materialistic conception of life, raises issues of the sanctity of human worth, and violates species integrity. Second, that patenting will lead to increased animal suffering and inappropriate human control over animal life. Third, that other countries do not permit the patenting of animals, leading to potential adverse economic implications for the third world. Fourth, that patenting promotes environmentally unsound policies. And fifth, that patenting produces excessive burdens on American agriculture in the form of increased costs to consumers, concentration in production of animals, payments of royalties for succeeding generations of animals, and so forth. Yes?
I think there's a more important one. You mentioned something. It's got to have a natural ending. Or if we take over everything and wreck us.
That's one of the arguments, certainly. Environmental concerns and the question of messing around with species, although I would point out that species differentiations are not always that clear.
That's what I mean. You may make something with a different gene cell, and you will know all of the potential.
The counter argument for that traditionally is that by doing manipulations of the genes on a higher organism, you're talking about an animal that has 50 to 100,000 genes. You're perhaps playing around with 1 to 20 of those genes because you're really limited with today's technology to messing around with things that are controlled by one gene or a cluster of genes that are close to one another on a chromosome. Yes?
By refusing to patent something like that, you wouldn't be preventing them from being produced.
That's correct. It could still take place. And I'm sorry, just to continue with that, the argument has been that traditional breeding practices also are not good for species, because when you're trying to make a dog or a cat or a cow with certain characteristics, because of the inbreeding that you go through, you also come up with a lot of bad traits in those animals. And so some people argue that it's better to go in and engineer just one thing than to do traditional breeding methods, which are also cruel to animals in some ways. I'm going to cut off.
Yeah, I think I want to let Deb sit down. She's been on her feet for a time. I'm going to open it up to the rest of you. What fascinates me was the first one. I've got it right in front of me. In this context, this rationalist, humanist, Unitarian, universalist context, we got metaphysical and theological concerns? I don't know. You know. Do we think, with Joyce Kilmer, that only God can make a tree?
I think lots of angelos have enjoyed it. I also enjoy gardening. There are many, many plants in my garden that did not exist until human beings started to mess around with them.
I remember being fascinated the first time, this was quite a few years ago, when I read that they followed a gene that made the firefly light up. They took that gene and put it in a tobacco plant, and the tobacco plant would glow at night. I was thinking, now, if you did that to humans, you could read without a light.
I was fascinated with this argument that the economics would take care of it. And one of the things that I remembered was a recent, I think it was a NOVA presentation, in which they were talking about isolating the gene that caused Hodgkin's disease, and that we may have problems saying that this is immoral if someone discovers how to cure this disease genetically, which looks like the only way it will ever be able to be cured. So that may be something that we have to deal with when it actually really saves lives.
One thing I want to throw in, just leave it hanging out there, is how far up the chain of life do you go? Mouse? Dog? cat, ape, people? I don't know.
Mike, you can't pat the human, and the reason is found in another section of the Constitution.
Slavery.
The 13th Amendment, which says that one person cannot have a property interest even limited in another human being.
Right, but what is a human being? If you've got something that's a mix of, say, a chimp and a human, is it a human? I don't know.
Well, that first quote again, it says something about human worth or something.
Which one?
On the...
Patenting raises metaphysical and theological concerns, e.g., promotes a materialistic conception of life.
And also, you can get a patent on an organism. That would be there.
Oh.
Well, I asked sort of a different question. When the patent office, the only place that controls, I've always heard of the alternate press, that the agents, the groups that have the rest of the pie are really the ones that control who gets the patent, not the patent office. In other words, is that just a myth, or is there a relationship between the organizations that have a piece of the pie and the patent office, so they can come in and make the fight that no, it's not patentable because, you know, we already have
it. Okay, Only the United States government can issue a patent. After a patent is issued, a competitor can say, wait a minute, you shouldn't have gotten that patent because it infringes our patent. And then you fight it out in court. There are statutory methods for people to intervene in the patent granting process, although that's fairly unusual. Because a patent application process is a process strictly between the inventor and the patent office. It's an ex parte type proceeding.
What about all the things they say that you read in the papers about Detroit prevents a decent carburetor from being patented by pressuring the patent office to not? Is that all myth, or is there?
I've never quite figured out some of that. There are ways that members of the public can make prior art known to the patent office. And that's generally in different types of re-examination procedures. Somebody can ask for re-examination of a patent, in which case the patent office can narrow the claims of the patent and issue another document which has less property to it. The other place is basically through infringement lawsuits.
Yeah, so really it's the most powerful. In theory, if you have enough money, you can fight, you can prevent a patent from being used just by keeping a person in court.
That's the problem with the patent system, that litigation in the patent area is, if anything, more expensive than litigation in other areas. And that's a problem in biotechnology right now. And the problem came about because when the patent office is looking at granting patents, and what they are looking at is what is out there already, you have a new technology. Some of the people who got in on this early and got some of the early patents got a very big piece of the pie. And they got a piece of the pie that perhaps a lot of other people need to use to make improvements. And so they need to get a license from the owner of those early patents to practice their invention. And when you have something that's that wide open, you've got people out there who got a lot of intellectual property, you're generating a lot of litigation, and it's very expensive. And a lot of it is being resolved by companies just doing mutual cross-licensing agreements. Here, you can use these, we can use those, and call it quits because nobody can afford to litigate it.
Either that, or surely the company could set up shop in some other country where it wasn't patented already. And you just take it abroad and do it.
Would that mean that you can't import it into the United States, whatever it is?
There's some fairly recent legislation on that, and I'm really not that familiar with it. But there are ways to limit importing, things like that.
Again,
I'm not even going to talk about it because I really don't.
Presumably, again, the government's not going to do it for you. You'd have to go to law to stop somebody doing it. Hey.
So you're talking about economics, liberal politics, and with respect to the patent office, if my memory serves me correct, please help me out on this. The French research team that came up with the first treatment for AIDS but it was the U.S. Patent Office that said, oh no, we're going to give it to an American research team, even though the Americans were years behind. Economics, depending on who is leaning on who, there has to be a way that people making this decision are influenced by outside factors. Which
it's surprising if they weren't.
Well, that's true. Right. It's very frustrating.
Yeah. Dave.
I don't know of instances where patentable items specifically were banned from being imported. But I know of a situation with Apple Computer Corporation where copyrightable information was prohibited from import from a country where the copyright wasn't in effect. They built some clones of Apple II computers, and Apple computers successfully prohibited the importation of those computers as a violation of copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
Copyright law allows for forfeiture of patents. You know, somebody is selling those, go to court and basically seize them.
Well, the beautiful cases, the United States government against 10,000 fake Gucci watches. Yeah. the names of these things are incredible.
The theological argument goes back to our directive, so to speak, or you know, what we consider a directive. It goes back to what Warren's services were about last fall, about how do we perform domination over animals. You know, are we stewards or are we dominators in terms of manipulating those factors? And we've been manipulating plants and animals for years. You know, is this an extension of that, or is it really radically new? You know.
Oh,
just
so far, no answers.
Yeah. We have to make a distinction between traditional hybridization, where you leave the wild nature will come back and straighten things out, and this other kind of change that's going to be self-replicating.
Well, that happened. I should mention that Deb also has a bachelor's degree in biology. So, you know, she ain't just a lawyer. You take one of these self-replicating genres, put it into the general population, is it going to work back to the...
Well, I can't say that. Model. One of the problems with genetic engineering, you know, back in the early 70s when we first learned how to put a foreign piece of DNA into a bug, everybody thought this is it, this is the greatest thing in the world, and they predicted that the biotechnology industry was going to take off instantly. Well, it hasn't, and it's been sputtering along. In fact, you talk about popular press, Fortune magazine, March 12, 1990, biotech stocks are poised to pay off in the 1990s. It's taken a lot longer for this industry to get up and going, and one of the reasons is that when they first started putting a lot of genetic information into bugs, the bugs were spitting it out again. you couldn't make it work quite as easily as they thought. Now, I'm not an expert technically in this area. All this stuff has happened since I got my degree, so like, I would have taught a lot of this in college. But that was a problem. But no, you can get a stable insertion of genetic material into an organism, and it is self-replicating, and it is a problem. And I mean, I think that there is a distinct difference between traditional breeding methods and putting a gene from a human into a mouse.
That's good.
Can I say two things? I think it's unethical to raise an animal to suffer. And the other, perhaps those mice wouldn't be so handy because they're all prone to cancer. Maybe they're all bad off at some point and not be able to do the same
thing.
I had kind of different sort of questions when I knew that I wanted. Suppose that there's some atmosphere intellectual property for discovery. And it is very biotechnology, and as she starts to produce, or hopefully ever produce whatever this discovery is, keeping in mind that anyone who begins production discovers bugs and things, not biological conditions, you know, quirks that need to be ironed out, and presumably irons them out. To what degree does are these considered part of the intellectual, the original discovery, and to what degree do these become a new discovery, and who determines that? Is it not determinable as a question? Is it obligatory to the inventor to go back and say, hey, I think I've, you know, removed course to the extent that this isn't the original discovery? Does the patent office?
You are only obligated when you apply for a patent to be truthful with the patent office at the time your patent is being prosecuted. So there's no requirement on you to tell them things you don't know. But if you want to protect something that is distinctly different and is an improvement, all patents are presumably improvements on something that was there before. You go back and get another patent.
But if nobody takes you up on it, competitor, whoever, then go on unless somebody else. I was just thinking, particularly with biotechnology, I could see this happening with almost every generation. And of course, if it's in writing, it's in the reviews very quickly, that would be very soon. Very soon.
You just yawning?
No,
okay.
No, I'm just really concerned about, I hear all this animal rights stuff. And the idea of having a mouse that can get cancer easily just is very appealing to me and very exciting. And I think that we are talking out of two sides of our mouths. If we are eating meat at our dinner table and being concerned about a goddamn rat, think of the dollars and the human suffering that has gone on because of cancer. And it's the thought of we have now a rat that gets cancer more easily that we might have a little bit quicker access to a cure for cancer, I think is absolutely tremendous. And someone mentioned that these research animals might have an impact on health. There is no doubt that everyone in this room has benefited from animal research. Now, I'm not saying that animal research can't be improved, but our lives are better today because of animal research.
Too many of them, the same reason.
You know, I think that this is at the crux of the problem with animal research and patentability of life, at least to me, is the dilemma that we have not resolved in our own minds. For ages, human beings have been very pragmatic, and they have used other life forms to their own advantage. If it pleased them to torture them, they would torture them. If it pleased them to use them as beasts of burden, they would use them as beasts of burden. Some became domesticated and there was almost a kind of symbiotic relationship. But there's no question that we've used animals historically to our own advantage quite and not even thought about the impact on the animal. Then there's another kind of growing awareness on our part of allowing other human beings to be alive, not deliberately trampling on them or hurting them, with a widening in our own minds as to who counts as human. I mean, in the old days, it was just the members of your own tribe, or your own community, or your own sex, or your own color, or your own nationality, or whatever. And I think we now have a growing awareness that because somebody is a different color, sex, age, language than us, they still have certain basic rights. So to me, one of the dilemmas in all of this is, when do you convert from this idea that you can use microbes, which I still regard as things, I mean, I don't, consciousness, I'm not concerned about providing oil for oil-eating microbes. I mean, they can starve as far as I'm concerned. When we do care, some of us care about dogs, and some of us care about rats and rabbits, you know, sort of domesticated kind. But supposing somebody introduces something that turns a dog into an animal as intelligent as a human being.
Oh, I wouldn't help it. But my dog is already really quite close.
Then own and use, I mean, anybody who's read science fiction is familiar with this problem, it pops up in lots of stories. But I mean, I think that's the dilemma that we haven't really addressed, and that is, at what point in life forms, do we begin to say we have an obligation?
Wait, take the C&I dogs, for example, who are a lifeline for live people with the bad vision. You know, there you have a closeness that becomes a symbiotic relationship because the human
being depends on it.
So, you know, then you have an example of a certain blinding crutch.
And you also, to your utility argument, too, I would have to tell you that when I was in graduate school in North Carolina, I had a friend who worked at the VA hospital. He was a physician. And he took me into their cat laboratory, where I believe that it's marvelous work. That is, they identified sections of the brain, which sections of the brain controlled which kinds of functions. And how they did it, I think they used about 10 cats a day. They took the cats, they couldn't give them any kind of anesthetic, because that would have spoiled function of the brain. And they took the skull off the unanesthetized cat and clamped it, sort of just above through the ears and through here to keep the head entirely still. And most cats would live, they'd live between 8 hours and say 30 hours. And he would, this guy was really admiring the cats that lived 30 hours. He'd say, boy, that animal's got real, get up and go. You know, that's hanging in for 30 hours. In incredible pain. And it would stimulate various sections of the brain which were exposed. And then either, you know, a paw would wiggle or something would happen.
And when I have my brain surgery, I will be so glad that that was done.
I won't.
Alan tells me we have to cut it off real soon. I do want to say, you know, for myself anyway, I won't speak for you. I've enjoyed it. It's been interesting, as I said last week, getting back to the public library. It's been interesting being a lay minister. And very interesting thinking about the sorts of things that we've tried to raise here. I haven't heard too many answers today. I haven't heard too many answers along the way. I hope we have asked the right questions. It has been a great pleasure.
And I would just like to add that what is so pleasurable for me is when we open up discussion, there are so many good questions and so many good comments. I get re-reminded what a nice and an interesting bunch of people you are. So why don't you applaud yourself? Hey. Very much, Deb, for giving us the basic information for today's discussion.
Deb says you can stay around for a little bit if anybody's got any questions. Vice President.
I do have something.
Way back in the tradition of starting the lay ministry in Prairie, there was a plant. I suspect it probably died. There was a plant that was passed on from lay minister to lay minister. And if we can, let's symbolically pass that plant on to you. Mike and Norma, you know, I have a different house, not a new house, but a different house. And this is the first spring, right, in that house. And so they've been discovering all of the organisms there. So symbolically, we are passing one of those plants onto you in thanks for your lay ministry. And you didn't let us applaud you. You changed it on us. So for now, thank you. It's a joy to look out every now and then and see some faces that I don't know. And in Prairie, we like to have some of you introduce yourselves if you're a visitor. At the same time, if people that are here have anything to share that's happened in their life recently, we'd appreciate that. I'm looking out and recognizing Richard Perry sitting there. What's it been, about 15 years ago since you were a lay minister in this group?
15 years, and 15 years I still haven't found a society that sings better than
Perry. Welcome back.
He doesn't ever go to church.
Not letting you introduce yourself.
But my wife, Karen Myers, we're living in San Diego now. San Diego.
Is
Is there anyone else that would like to?
Alice and I are happy to have our son Norman with us for a short time. He's also from California.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Keep watching that prairie. It's changing every day. Anyone else? Yes.
My name is Ann. I'm in the process of moving up from Woodstock, Illinois to Madison. Greg's affiliated with a combination congregational and Unitarian Universalist Church, which we finally call the Congregation Meeting. My daughter Emily brought me here this morning.
Thanks for coming. Do we have other things to share or announcements? Rachel?
Next Saturday, a wonderful opportunity is presenting itself to all Prairie members and friends. We give our money and our love to Prairie, and we get a lot from Prairie. We're asking you to sacrifice a few hours of time to help do some very necessary chores around here, both inside and out. And I'm going to pass around a sign-up, the usual sign-up sheet. And if you don't sign up, we'll call you. Anyway.
Does anyone know the whereabouts of the contribution basket that we all
Saturday, 9:30 to 3.
There. Julie has the contribution basket. We can send it one side across the other.
Barbara, you had the...
If anyone is going to the big concert in Milwaukee during General Assembly, I'd like to go, but I'd rather not go alone. Just speak to me afterwards. The Saturday night, June the something like the 24th.
I have a word about Prairie's bus trip to the Chicago Art Institute. I believe our announcement said that on the 7th of May was the deadline, and we've extended the deadline until tomorrow. We have 34 people who are signed up, and we still have seats on the bus if anyone would like to go. We'd like to have you go very much.
You should remember that Bonnie Hands make life work.
See Pat Cochrane
or Donna Murdock.
Or yes,
Julie.
Next Sunday is a celebration of transitions and rites of passage. Several families are going to have their children dedicated. Aaron Bosch is conducting that service, so if you are interested in having input into that, please contact her. I also wanted to announce that the program committee is meeting tomorrow night here at the Society Building at 7:30.
Jack?
I wanted to remind the board members of your board meeting not tomorrow night, but a week from tomorrow night on the 23rd.
Jack, I want to know why you're in a suit today.
I'm called for. Any other than?
I'm letting you know that this is the 50th anniversary of my graduation from the University of Wisconsin.
Let's see, that makes sure.
John Chalet was mentioned.
Oh, so we're dressed up. I know that 4 years ago when I went to the same thing, I didn't say a word.
We have a closing song, but before we do that, Linda, yes.
So we're going to be gone from early June to early July, and we're wondering if there's someone who needs a place to stay and would take care of our pets. A dog, two cats, a snake is optional. Alternatively, if someone would, we would be willing to pay someone to take care of the dog or the cats.
Right. It's a much better deal than our place.
Can I know that if anybody would needs to
cheaply rent a place for all of July, I will be in Germany, and I would also be interested in renting a place to somebody. It's not childproof, though, it's something for adults. This is right across from Winona, right across from Winona. It's a, I would say, a roomy two-bedroom place.
All this week we've been trying to come up with music that sort of fits the theme of the particular morning meeting. We stretched it pretty far. I think we take it to its limit today. Number 49, which is, you got a right, I got a right, we all got a right for the tree of life.
Potluck lunch, bring food.